Okay, well, I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to tell you about the tabletop physics experiments we're doing in University of Nevada, Reno. I just wanted to start off with a quick advertisement that our lab's actually moving in January to Northwestern University, to the newly established Center for Fundamental Physics at Low Energy, where the idea is that there'll be several more of these kind of small-scale tabletop experiments. So this is being led by Gerald Gabriels. And I just want to also emphasize that we're planning a search for another new faculty member next fall. So if you guys know postdocs who may be interested, please encourage them to apply. And also, there are numerous opportunities for students and postdocs for working at this new center. Okay, so our lab is, I guess, one theme that kind of encompasses a lot of the work we do is using so-called resonance sensors to do fundamental physics experiments. And today, I was going to tell you about some of the activity going on in two areas. So first, I'm going to talk about some work where we take advantage of a very high-quality mechanical resonance to look for new physics, in particular to test gravity at short length scales, and possibly in the future, we're thinking about using this technology to look for gravitational waves. And in the second half of my talk, I'm going to talk about an experiment that's under development where we're planning on using a very high-quality spin resonance, namely laser-polarized gases, to look for exotic spin-dependent forces where the target we have in mind is the QCD axion. Okay, so we already heard a nice talk from Ho-Jung earlier this afternoon about looking for deviations from Newtonian gravity. And so as he mentioned, there are a number of theories beyond the standard model that suggest this Newtonian potential between two masses will get modified at some length scale if I bring the masses close enough together. So lambda here is the Compton wavelength of the new exotic particle that's responsible for changing the form of this interaction. And alpha is some dimensionless number, which is just telling you the strength of that interaction relative to gravity. And so there are a number of theories, for example, including supersymmetry and string theory, or also the idea that it could be particles in large extra dimensions in space, that would suggest that we will start to see a deviation from this potential at distances below the millimeter length scale, where this strength parameter here could actually be quite large. So down at kind of micron distances, this strength parameter could be on the order of a billion, and we would still not have any experimental constraint on that. So experiments of this nature are difficult for a couple reasons, one of which simply has to do with the weakness of the gravitational force and how it scales. So if I take two objects, for example, take spheres, and I have as dense material as I can find on Earth, let's say gold, and I ask, well, if I bring these spheres close together, as close as possible, where they're separated by twice their radius, we can look at how the gravitational Newtonian force between them scales, and it goes like the positive fourth power of the size scale. So when I shrink this system down, where I make the spheres small and the distance between them small, then even for a dense material like gold, this force at the 10 micron length scale is on the order of 10 to the minus 21 newtons, which is quite small. And so for the benefit of those of us that don't do precision force measure for a living, I thought I'd just put a point of scale up. So if you imagine that if you had a person standing on a bathroom scale, if that person weighs about, say, 70 kilograms, then the force in the Earth's gravitational field would be about 700 newtons exerted on the scale. And if your scale had a pretty precise spring in it, you might be able to tell the difference between, say, 700 or 700.1. But if I wanted to be able to resolve, for example, if extra dust mite came along and landed on their shoulder, I would need to be able to measure forces at the 10 to the minus 7 newton level. Or, for example, if a bacteria came along 10 to the minus 15 newtons, or a virus 10 to the minus 19 newtons, or how about an extra single carbon atom, I would have to have a force sensitivity about 10 to the minus 25 newtons. So the force we're talking about measuring is somewhere in between that level, between the virus and an extra carbon atom. As another point of reference, in the condensed matter physics community, the atomic force microscope, which is a highly sensitive instrument, is typically measuring forces that are on the order of 10 to the minus 11 newtons. So we're talking about 10 orders of magnitude or so below that in order to look for these kind of gravitational effects. So in addition to the really tiny nature of the gravitational force, we also have to contend with background forces from electromagnetism that are actually getting stronger as we get things close together. And we've already had some discussion about this earlier this afternoon. so I won't belabor too much at this point, but we talked about the Casimir effect, or even if I have no electrical potential difference between conducting surfaces, we can have an attractive force between the plates due to quantum vacuum fluctuations. There's also was a discussion of electrostatic patch potentials, so even quote-unquote good conductors have local work function variations over their surface, and this can cause spurious electromagnetic forces in these experiments. That's a challenge for these gravitational tests. So I can look in now the parameter space for corrections to gravity of this kind. And so now I'm kind of zooming in at the length scale here of about 1 micron, going from 100 microns down to about 10 nanometers. And I'm plotting corrections of this Yukawa-type form here of the Newtonian potential, where I have this lambda length scale on the horizontal scale and on the vertical scale. I have this strength parameter alpha. So you'll notice this goes down to 1 times gravity at the bottom, all the way up to 10 to the 15 times gravity here at the top. So the area that's shaded off in the yellow is where the current experimental bounds are. And so at the largest length scales on this plot, the best bounds by far are coming from the precision torsion balance experiments from the University of Washington. And I think we'll hear something about those experiments later in the conference, where they've been able to set a bound about 1 times gravity, close to around 50 microns or so. At slightly shorter length scales, around 10 microns, the best limits come from microcantilever experiments. And below 10 microns, the best limits come from adaptations of Casimir force type experiments, for example, in this region over here. The shaded regions here are some of the theoretical predictions from the theories I mentioned earlier. Okay, so these systems rely on some sort of mechanical mechanism, whether it's a torsion fiber or a cantilever or a torsional oscillator. And so let's look at one particular example, the cantilever beam. And the cantilever beam is basically a resonant force detector. And so we can think about it like a spring. It's a diving board. If I apply a force on the tip, I'll get some displacement. And if that force happens to be applied at the natural resonance frequency of this oscillator, then I can get a very large enhancement of amplitude. This is a nice way of taking a really tiny force and transducing it into a very big measurable displacement. And the amplitude is enhanced by this mechanical quality factor, which for these devices can be on the order of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 even, depending on what mechanical system we're looking at. So you can ask, well, what's the theoretical limit on the sensitivity of these devices? And so one fundamental limit just comes from the thermal Brownian motion. So due to the fact that this oscillator is in contact with a heat bath at some finite temperature, I can write down the equipartition theorem from statistical mechanics. And from that, I can derive in the presence of these random thermal excitations, what is the minimum detectable force I can see on top of that background of these thermal kicks. And that force goes like the thermal energy KT times the spring constant of the oscillator times the measurement bandwidth divided by this mechanical quality factor and the mechanical frequency all to the 1/2 power. So one way of improving this is to think about reducing this mechanical or increasing this mechanical quality factor, in other words, removing dissipation or friction in the system. And as a way of doing that, we can think about replacing these solid-state mechanical oscillators with actually an optically levitated sensor. So in the case of the cantilever beam, there's some dissipation in this oscillator that has to do with mechanisms like the clamping of the oscillator or surface imperfections or even thermoelastic dissipation if the material flexes. And so you can replace this solid state system with an optically levitated particle. And so the system we have in mind here is a dielectric nanosphere. So this dielectric object has some polarizability, and if you shine a laser on it, you induce an electric dipole moment. And when you do that, then the interaction of the laser with the with that dipole moment then produces an optical potential called the optical dipole potential, which can trap a dielectric object near the focus of an intense laser beam. This is the same force that's responsible for trapping the atoms in an optical lattice, for example, that we heard about earlier this morning. So the polarizability of this object, it scales with the volume, unlike for a single atom, and one can generate fairly deep optical potentials this way. And then by measuring the center of mass motion of this optically trapped object, now I've decoupled the system from the mechanical surroundings in some way. There's no more clamping mechanism that's holding onto this, no more solid state, at least, clamping mechanism holding onto this thing. And also, I'm no longer concerned with internal materials loss and dissipation if I'm only looking at the center of mass of the oscillator. And so using this technique with the levitated sensor, then one can get fantastically good force sensitivity. So now I'm going to rewriting this equation for the minimum detectable force in a different way. So this is the thermal energy KT. This is the damping coefficient, and this is the mass. And here I'm going to assume that we're in a ultra high vacuum environment, so that the damping due to collisions with the background gas is very, very small, and that's going to be the dominant term here that's affecting this sensitivity. And so I can plot then as a function of the size of a sphere, ranging from 10 nanometers here up to tens of microns, what is the minimum detectable force that you can see, or the force sensitivity that you can see. And so you can see here for submicron size objects, you can get sensitivities that are on the order of 10 to the minus 21 newtons per hertz, which is right in the range that's interesting for these gravitational experiments.
What about the laser beams moving in the inertial frame?
Yeah, so the laser is bouncing off of mirrors and so forth, and so you can have heating mechanism from vibrational noise, and that's a factor that has to be considered in these setups. So it's a little bit misleading to say it's completely removed from the mechanical environment, but the kinds of mechanisms that tend to limit the solid state oscillators are not the ones that are limiting this. And so it's a different set of problems you worry about. It turns out, as I'll show with data, I mean, we think the mechanical noise from vibrating mirrors are reasonably under control. So you can also look at the acceleration sensitivity. So this is now the red line here, where acceleration sensitivity is improving for larger size trapped objects and getting down to the level of nano g's per hertz for objects of micron, over micron sizes. So the cantilever kind of sensors that I mentioned earlier are kind of operating somewhere up in here in terms of force sensitivity. And using these levitated nanospheres, sensitivities as low as 20 zeptonewtons per root hertz were demonstrated back in 2013. This deviation here you're seeing from the straight line is due to what's known as photon recoil heating. So the particle is in an optical trap, and it's scattering discrete photons that are making up that trap. And that causes a momentum diffusion process, which is a heating mechanism that does impose some quantum limit here at the higher end of the scale. But you can see you can stay pretty close to this theoretical limit, at least at this pressure, over quite a range of different sizes for the particles. So the idea in our lab, we're setting up or running an experiment where we're looking to use these levitated particles for short distance gravity measurement. So the basic cartoon of the setup is this. We have an optical cavity, and inside the optical cavity, I have a standing wave of light that's reflecting from one of the mirrors. And the nanoparticle here is trapped at the locations of maximal intensity, or at any of the antinodes along the length of this cavity. So I can trap a sub-wavelength particle here and localize it at one of the antinodes. Where I trap the particle using one laser and using a second laser, I can both cool the particle and also read out its location as its motion changes the phase of the light that reflects back from the cavity. So the particle is kept near one of the mirrors of the cavity. In this case, it's a thin membrane made out of silicon nitride that's stationary, that's coated with gold. And then behind that mirror, we have a device that acts as the source mass for the gravitational experiment. This is a device consisting of alternating sections of gold and silicon material that moves up and down this way on a MEMS actuator device that we built. So the idea is that as this structure moves up and down, the dense gold sections and the less dense silicon sections will exert a different amount of gravitational force on the sphere. And we can modulate that force by driving this device up and down at the mechanical resonance frequency of this particle in the optical trap, which is determined by the light intensity and gradient. And so then using this kind of system, because we can get this sensitivity and because we can localize the particle very close to a surface, we project that it's possible to carve out several orders of magnitude in this parameter space for searching for these new exotic beyond the standard model gravitational corrections that are on the micron scale. Okay, so the experimental setup looks actually more like this. This is one of the particles that we trap. It's a 300 nanometer diameter glass bead. And so we have an optical cavity along this axis. This is the structure over here. So this mass device would be behind this mirror in the cartoon over here. We have an additional set of lasers that we call our dipole trapping beams. These are counterpropagating beams that we use to originally catch the particle. Then we have some beams that we use to cool the motion of the particle, and then we can transfer the particle from that initial trap into this optical cavity trap where we do the gravitational test. So here's a photo of the actual inside of the system. At the moment, we have this optical cavity along this axis. We have these dipole trapping beams where we initially catch the particle, which has a better trapping performance along this axis. And then the actuator that's holding the mass that moves up and down is up against the mirror, which you can't really see in this image here. So the mass itself is fabricated with gold and silicon to give a high density contrast, about a factor of 10 density contrast. We use MEMS techniques to fabricate this device. We basically take a silicon wafer and etch some pits into it, and then electroplate gold into the pits. And at that point, we take this structure. You can see after electroplating the gold, there's still some corrugation here on the surface. What we want is to have the gravitational force modulated as I scan this device back and forth, but not the electrostatic force modulated. And so this corrugation here would in principle be a problem for us. So what we do is take this device and then turn it upside down and actually then polish away the silicon from the backside. So we attach this gold to a glass substrate and then polish down the silicon. Here's the image of showing what that looks like in the middle of the process. We're removing the silicon from the top until we have a layer now of only 2 microns of silicon remaining in the final device. As you can see, the surface looks a lot smoother where you don't see the remnant of that electrostatic or a gold structure. So then the device is moved on a MEMS actuator, which is basically a capacitively driven cantilever beam. We apply a voltage on the bottom of the cantilever with respect to a metal electrode underneath it, and this oscillates the mass up and down. We get amplitudes of a few microns, which it's enough for to significantly modulate the force in our experiment. This is occurring on the other side of that shield membrane. Here's the image of the device that actuates the mass. So the particle originally gets trapped in a optical standing wave trap, where we have the dipole force coming from these 2 counterpropagating beams. So these focus at nearly the same point. And we have the polarization of these lasers chosen so that they're primarily orthogonally polarized, although we do let a little bit of the other polarization along the other axis. And this gives me some interference to create a shallow standing wave or a shallow optical lattice. So this is the force along the axis of this dipole beam as a function of distance. And if you kind of zoom in here, you can see that there's a corrugation here due to this lattice potential where we have the interference between the counterpropagating beams. And so along this axis, then there are many points at which you can trap one of these nanoparticles. And so in fact, if we perturb the system with a laser after we trap a nanoparticle, we can make a transition from one lattice site to the other, where this spacing here is given by the half wavelength of the laser. In our case, that's about 532 nanometers. So to catch these things in the trap, it actually requires quite a bit of force. So we take these particles and we apply them onto a glass substrate. And basically, we use a high-power piezoceramic actuator to shake this glass substrate and knock the particles off. And so it turns out that just due to the van der Waals force, the acceleration required to knock this thing off goes like the 1/radius squared of the particle. And when you get things that are as small as what we're working with at this 300 nanometer kind of diameter, you actually need an acceleration of about 10 to the 7 g's of this glass substrate to knock the thing off. And in fact, we take a laser and we bounce it off the end of this thing onto a segmented photodetector. And sure enough, we actually measure when the acceleration is of order 10 to the 7 g's, they start to fall off. And so if we go any higher than that, then we tend to start breaking things and stuff falls apart. So luckily for us, this is still within the limits of possibility here for this particular size. So then once we release the things, they sort of fall. I have a little movie here. This is a illustration kind of what it looks like when they get caught in the optical trap. This is an earlier version of our chamber where we have two beams coming in from the side. You're seeing the scattered light off the edge of the enclosure here. So those beams come to a focus in the center, and we shake this device here. Now, gravity is pointing down in the picture, so the particles are kind of slowly coming down into gravity, and then you can see in this case they get stuck in the center, and in this case we got a few that kind of joined together and started spinning around. And so you can see this movie is not slowed down. This is in real time, so the particles are falling really, really slowly. And so we have to catch the particles in the trap when the pressure is actually not all the way at high vacuum, right? Because we want to have some damping from the gas collision so that the kinetic energy can be taken out once, and the particle can actually get stuck in the trap as opposed to just flying through the potential and ballistically flying through it. So, but in order to get the sensitivity as impressive as the numbers I was advertising, you do need to be in a high vacuum environment, and so you have to have a way of removing the air after you catch the particle. And so this, at first, didn't seem like it was going to be a very big problem, but our group and several other groups encountered several problems with this, where we were seeing mysterious instabilities where the particles would tend to get lost when you pump out the gas. And so this is just a plot showing some of the data we took on statistics of if you tried to pump out the gas, no matter how slowly you went, the particle would get kicked out of the trap as you pump out the system. And this was very puzzling, I think, in part because the trapping depth in terms of temperature here is in some cases exceeding 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin. Yet there's some force involved that's big enough to knock these things out when you pump the air out. And so this turned out to be due to what we believe is due to the radiometric force. And so this is a picture of a toy you can buy now in a museum store. But back in the 1800s, Crookes had a device like this, and he thought he had discovered radiation pressure. And so what this is a glass bulb here that's mostly evacuated. It still has a little bit of residual gas in it. And inside, you have this device that can spin, where there are these vanes, one side of which is dark or highly absorbing, and the other side is bright or highly reflective. And so when you shine light on this thing, if radiation pressure was actually making this thing spin, you'd see it spin the opposite direction from where it's going. And in fact, it's spinning the wrong way. And the reason it's spinning the wrong way is because of this so-called radiometric force. So the photons are heating up the black absorbing surface, and then that hot temperature is heating up the gas that bounces off the surface and creating currents of the air molecules that are actually driving it the opposite direction. And so this really shows that this radiometric force can dominate over the radiation pressure. And we believe a similar mechanism is at play in our optical trap, where we have this sphere that's trapped. And because the laser has some intensity profile, there's an uneven heating of the surface of the particle, which then can cause currents of these gas molecules to knock the particle out. And it turns out this is the most important when the mean free path is of order the size of the object. And so you can analyze that situation, and so you'll find actually that this is this photothermal or radiometric force as a function of pressure. There's a band here where this radiometric force is more or less staying constant at pressures of order tens of torr down to 10 so millitorr or so. And so as you're pumping the air out, when you start off at a few torr, for example, like we do, this radiometric force is basically staying at a constant value, whereas the gas damping from the collisions or from gas collisions is decreasing. So while this force is staying constant and your damping is decreasing, then you wind up heating up the center mass temperature of the particles, and eventually they get kicked out of the trap. And so what you need then is to keep the heating rate less than this gas damping rate in order to keep the particle around. And so a way of doing that is to use optical feedback or laser feedback cooling. And so the way we do that is after we catch the particle in this trap, we image the scattered light from the particle onto these segmented quadrant photodetectors. And from that, we can basically get the position information of how the particle is moving. Then we take that position signal and we phase shift it to get a velocity signal proportional to the instantaneous velocity of the particle. And then that velocity signal is fed to some acousto-optic modulators where I can now modulate the strength of the laser in such a way that I produce a velocity-dependent force or a velocity-dependent damping on the system. And so we do this in all three directions, where we have a laser to cool each axis. And so when we do that, we cool the motion and we also drop the temperature of the system, of the center mass temperature. And so you might worry, well, now I'm damping it, am I going to lose sensitivity because I needed this really high mechanical quality factor to get these really high sensitivities? It turns out you actually do not hurt the sensitivity because this minimum detectable force scales like the square root of the temperature over this quality factor. And under these kind of cooling schemes, you tend to reduce the quality factor and the temperature by essentially the same amount, so that you get to keep the same sensitivity you would have had without that. Also, this feedback cooling is needed in the high vacuum limit to mitigate this heating mechanism I mentioned earlier from this photon recoil from this discrete scattering of photons in the trap. So once you are in, once you apply the feedback, you can pump the air out, you can get to high vacuum, and then you can turn the cooling rate down substantially and still maintain the particle in a stable trap. So this really shows that the gas is contributing to the loss mechanism in this kind of one torr range. So once you're at the high vacuum limit, then you can, of course, get very good sensitivity. And so here's some data with a 300 nanometer sphere, where we're demonstrating integrating down the force sensitivity over a 10 to the 5 second integration time, where we can now measure forces that are down at the level of zeptonewton. So this is 6 to the 10 to the minus 21 newtons using the system. And so, yeah.
Is there a frequency shift?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of an optical spring effect from the feedback. If you're feeding back to not only the velocity, but a little bit of the position as well, you can shift the resonant frequency at the same time as you damp. That's right. Yeah, so the temperature is kind of proportional to the area under this curve, and we've also dropped the temperature down to, well, to millikelvin kind of range rather than Kelvin range. So the sensitivity is about 1.6 attonewtons per hertz, which is limited by technical laser noise in this case. So when you're in the business of looking for these hypothetical forces beyond gravity, you'd like to convince yourself that if you had a force that was really small, you'd actually be able to see it. And so it's nice to do some calibration of the system where you apply some known force. And so we can do that in a couple of different ways. So it turns out that these particles, for the most extent, are neutral about 90% of the time. And they tend to stay neutral. But sometimes we catch particles that have either one or two excess electrons on them. And then along the axis of our optical cavity here, we have a set of electrodes where we can apply voltage so that we have a known electric field applied to the particle. And so from that known electric field, then I can get a calibrated force that I can use to make sure that I'm actually measuring this force as small as I claim. For those particles which happen to have no charge, it's also possible to use this corrugated optical standing wave potential as a calibration tool. So by kicking the particle and making it hop to an adjacent site, I have this length spacing here that's the half wavelength of the laser, which I can use as a ruler to basically calibrate this displacement spectrum to know that I'm, in fact, measuring the displacements that I think I am.
Would you measure to get on my axis?
So in this case, or yes. Yeah, this is the signal from that segmented photodetector.
Okay,
so this is what the limit would be at the pressures we're currently at if we did not have the technical laser noise. So we have about an order of magnitude or so improvement there that we're currently working on. And so the next stage after we catch after we have the particle in that trap, we've now been able to trap the particle in this optical cavity trap where I have two lasers in the cavity, one of which traps the particle and a second one can cool it and also read out its position. And so this cavity here is the this is the cartoon version of that where the gravity measurement is set to take place. So we've been successful at trapping beads in the cavity. Here's an image, I guess you can't see that clearly here, of one of the particles in the cavity. And we're now optimizing this system with the hopes of, in the next 6 months to a year, getting some initial results on that. So I just want to also mention later at this workshop, we're going to hear about some other levitated microsphere experiments in particular. From the groups at Stanford and Yale, where they have a different trapping geometry. We're going to hear about this single beam trap, where they're aiming at a little bit, looking at a little bit longer length scales using larger trapped particles. So you'll hear about that in the morning. One other thing we're thinking about for these sensors is gravitational wave detection. Let's see, how am I doing on time?
You have 25 minutes.
Okay, perfect. So these levitated particles actually could be interesting detectors for gravitational waves, particularly at the high frequency end of the spectrum. And so you can think about a system where I have an optical cavity that's substantially smaller than LIGO, so let's say a length of, say, 10 to 100 meters. And inside here, we have this trapped nanoparticle. And so we can think about this system kind of like a tunable version of this of Weber's type bar detector. So the idea is that a gravitational wave will come along and change the physical distance between these two mirrors. When that happens, then the particle here will get displaced relative to the location of the antinode of that standing wave, which will put a force on it and cause it to ring up, much like the bar detector here rings like a bell when the gravity wave comes along and matches its frequency. So in our case, you can tune the frequency of the optical trap just by adjusting the laser intensity, and you have sort of a tunable version of that. And so given the high sensitivity of these devices, if you have a 100-meter cavity, you can get strain sensitivity that's of order of 10 to the minus 22 per root hertz at frequencies of order hundreds of kilohertz, which is already in the territory where it's beating the advanced LIGO detector. And so it's a little bit different in style than those experiments in that the limitations here are due to thermal mechanical motion of the particle rather than laser shot noise, which is what's limiting LIGO at the high frequency end. So we essentially take LIGO's position measurement of this distance between the mirrors and turn it into a force measurement where we're limited by the Brownian motion of the particle rather than the resolution of the being able to measure the length of the cavity. And so we can plot for different objects. So for spheres, or actually disks, are actually more favorable. So for a 100-meter cavity, the strain sensitivity is now beating the advanced LIGO strain sensitivity, which is shown in the red curves, at frequencies above sort of tens of kilohertz. And this, there aren't very many astrophysical sources that are known at these really high frequencies, but one possibility for a signal was actually mentioned by Mina earlier this morning, namely from these black hole super radiance effects. One can get gravitational waves that are produced from axion annihilations. And for example, a gut scale axion, the predicted range of that is actually over the 100 kilohertz range. So these kind of techniques could potentially be useful for looking for this beyond the standard model kind of gravitational wave sources. Okay, so with the last 20-ish minutes, I wanted to mention the other activity going on in our group, which is a search for axions. So axions are quite generic theoretically. The QCD axion, of course, is very well motivated as it solves a strong CP problem, as Mina already covered. And the axion happens to have a mass range which quite naturally makes it a good candidate for dark matter. And there are a number of experiments searching for axions as dark matter, and actually we're going to hear a lot about some of these experiments later in this workshop. Our idea is to look for the axion not directly looking as the cosmic axion field, but rather to look for the axion as a force mediator for new exotic spin-dependent forces between objects when you get them very close together at distances as small as 30 microns. And so in this way, we can kind of source the axion locally in the lab as opposed to trying to detect the cosmic axion field. So the experiment that we're working on is called Ariadne, the axion resonant interaction detection experiment. And this is a collaboration between us at Nevada, as well as Mina here, and folks at Stanford, Indiana University, some of whom are here at this meeting, as well as the Yanis and the Center for Axion and Precision Physics in Korea. Our collaborator, Young-Ho Lee, actually is giving a talk in a couple days. He's from the Korean Measurement Standard Laboratory and is working on the magnetometers that we're using in this experiment. So Ariadne is trying to fill in part of the unexplored region of the parameter space for the QCD axion. So here's the parameter space, which is basically conveniently characterized in terms of one number, which is just the mass of the axion. And so there have been searches for the axions experimentally in these shaded bands here, which is a pretty small part of the allowed parameter space. The blue area here is what's been ruled out by astrophysics. So we know the axion has to be lighter than about 10 to the minus 2 EV due to the astrophysical data. The axion could be much lighter than that. Depending on the situation with inflation, there are certain cosmological models that disfavor axions below kind of micro EV range. But in principle, the axion could exist anywhere from here down. And there's really no experimental coverage in a lot of this window. So the ADMX experiment and its future upgrades, the CAS experiment and its upgrade YOXO will cover a fair amount of the space. But there's not much coverage in this kind of micro EV to milli EV range or down here. And so there are ideas for new experiments, some of which we'll hear about here, to kind of cover up this part of the range. Our experiment is aiming at closing in this window here for heavier mass axions in the range of 10 milli EV down to sort of tens of micro EV. And so you can kind of characterize these experiments according to the source of the axions and the coupling mechanism. And so the sources range from the cosmic dark matter axion and to solar axions to lab-produced axions. And the coupling can either be through photons or nucleons. The only running existing laboratory search that's looking at unconstrained parts of the parameter space is the ADMX experiment, looking for the coupling of photons. And there are ideas and experiments being developed to look for lower and higher frequency couplings with photons. There's the CASPER experiment, which I think we're going to hear about later, which is looking for cosmic dark matter axions coupling to nuclei. Ariadne is looking for lab-produced experiments, but coupling to the nuclei. Okay, and so the experiment works is to look for axion exchange between nucleons. And so the axion generally has two couplings. There's a scalar coupling, which is proportional to the parameter theta QCD. And there's also a pseudoscalar coupling, which looks like a derivative of the axion field. So in the non-relativistic limit, this looks like the gradient of the axion field dotted into the spin or sigma of the particle. And so if I bring together two nuclei, I can get several different kinds of interactions where the axion is acting as a force mediator. So in particular, I can have so-called monopole-monopole interactions where I have two copies of the scalar interaction here. I can have monopole-dipole interactions where I have one scalar and one pseudoscalar. And I can also have the dipole-dipole interactions where I have two pseudoscalars interactions at the vertices. So our experiment is looking for this monopole-dipole coupling. And so the way we do that is to look for spin-dependent forces. If I bring two fermions together, there's going to be this new axion-produced interaction potential between them that's going to depend on the distance between the fermions, as well as it's going to couple to the mass of one and the spin of another. And so this potential looks like the product of these coupling constants that I had on the previous slide times some distance dependence going like 1 over the square of this distance between them. There's an exponential here that describes the decay of this interaction at long distance. So the length scale here is just the Compton wavelength of the axion. So you have to get these objects close together within one Compton wavelength of the axion to have the force turn on. And then I also have this spin-dependent term where it couples to the sigma, so sigma dot r here. So because it couples to the sigma, which is proportional to the magnetic moment, we can think about this as an effective or a fictitious magnetic field. So we're kind of looking for this unpolarized mass here producing a fictitious magnetic field that's going to act on the spin. And so it's important to distinguish this is not like an ordinary magnetic field. It doesn't obey Maxwell's equations. It doesn't couple to moving charges or angular momentum. And importantly for us, it's not affected by magnetic shielding. And so it's possible to screen then regular magnetic fields where you would not be able to screen this effect. And so one idea for detecting these magnetic-like interactions is to use NMR. And so the idea is that you can take a spin. Let's look at a spin 1/2 helium-3 nucleus as an example. And then we bring some mass nearby at some close distance r. Now, if I apply an external magnetic field here on the spin, then I will generate an energy difference between the spin up and spin down states of this particle, where there's some energy difference that's set by the nuclear Larmor precession frequency. Now, if I bring in this mass at some close distance to the spin, then that effective fictitious magnetic field produced by the axion can modify this Larmor frequency, and we can see how the Larmor frequency gets changed as the mass is brought close by or taken away. And so there actually already have been experiments like this that have been done to look for these spin-dependent forces. So here's a plot showing the parameter space for the product of those two coupling constants, the scalar dipole coupling, as a function of the force range in centimeters going from about 30 microns up to about 10 centimeters, or equivalently in terms of the mass of the QCD axion, where the heavier axions are here at sort of the milli-EV level down into the micro-EV level. So the precision magnetometry experiments that were done of this type have been able to put bounds that are in this shaded blue zone up here. And when it was pointed out that if you take into account the best limits from astrophysics and combine them with the experimental limits, then it's possible to constrain the area shown here in this shaded tan zone. But if you were to ask, well, for the QCD axion, where do we expect the bound to be? It's actually down several orders of magnitude below where these combined bounds can reach, where the parameter space for the QCD axion is this band. Now, it's a band here because we don't know the value of theta QCD. It could go all the way to the bottom.
No. Well, for the QCD, no, it cannot go all the way to the bottom. It can go down to 10 to the minus 16.
That's what I mean by the bottom, the bottom of the band. There's a lower bound, right? So the lower bound is...
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So we know theta QCD has to be less than 10 to the minus 10 from the neutron EDM measurements. But at the same time, there's a certain amount of CP violation already in the standard model. And so from that, we can put an upper or lower bound on theta QCD about 10 to the minus 16. So if the axion exists, it should live somewhere in this band. So it's not an infinite bottom, you know, where you just keep saying it's smaller and smaller.
Well, we know there has to be something other than the standard model or we wouldn't be here. Right?
True.
That can interfere with the axion. And so there is, that lower bound is not.
Well,
that means you're saying you would require a tuning, right?
Yeah.
So anything below that, well, then it starts defeating the purpose. But sure, if you want to tune the 10 to the minus 16 and add the 10 to the minus 16 times several decimals.
Then the axion doesn't have a good reason to exist, though, in that case, right? So.
Well, no, we know that there's a source of TP that's the violation that's not in the standard model.
Oh, that's much, much bigger, actually. There's no reason why that theta contribution and that other contribution happen.
Yeah, this is just in the strong interaction, right?
This is from the CK. So the reason this theta is so small is because it comes at the free loop level,
right.
And it involves all three
families.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so most likely, if the axion exists, you'd expect to find it in this... in this range, okay. Not to say there's no way around that, right? But okay. So the idea with Ariadne is to use a resonant enhancement technique to improve the sensitivity on those previous measurements. And so again, let's think of a spin 1/2 nucleus, helium-3, and put it in an external field. So then we get an energy splitting between the spin up and spin down states, again, set by that nuclear Larmor resonance. But now, rather than simply bringing the mass nearby and seeing how it affects that Larmor resonance frequency, we can resonantly bring the mass close by and take it away. So we create basically a transverse magnetic field, which is oscillating in time. And so the idea is to basically modulate the distance between the mass and the spin, and therefore modulate this effective fictitious magnetic field precisely at the nuclear Larmor precession frequency. And so what that does is coherently drives the spin precession in the helium-3, which gives me a resonant enhancement where now we can pick up the transverse magnetization produced by that driving signal from the axion-mediated effective field. And so then you can detect that with a squid loop, for example, and we have a resonant enhancement factor by this quality factor, which is essentially the frequency here times the T2. And the T2 decoherence time for these systems can be quite large. And so the experiment looks more like this. rather than just those spheres. So we have a helium-3 gas that's inside of an enclosure, and it's laser polarized to get near unity polarization. And surrounding that helium-3 enclosure, there's a quartz block, which is coated with a thin film of niobium to act as a superconducting shield. Now, the source mass for the axion is this unpolarized tungsten gear here, which is brought close by. And so the idea is that this thing spins, and as the teeth of the spin, the teeth of this gear spin by, we choose it so that the frequency of the tooth passing matches that nuclear Larmor precession frequency and then drives the transverse magnetization, which we can pick up with a squid detector. How big is, sorry,
what? The segmented cylinder.
Ah, so it's about 3.8 centimeters across, and it's separated here by about, well, from center from the center of this to the edge is about 200 microns. So the fundamental limit in this case is due to quantum spin projection noise in the sample itself, which scales like the 1 over the volume times the density times the T2 all to the 1/2 power. So using this, we want to basically use a highly polarized sample to get the maximal sensitivity. You can't use ordinary magnetic fields in our case because of this Boltzmann factor. So we use optical pumping techniques. So we use something called metastability exchange optical pumping. Here's a picture of the apparatus from our collaborators at Indiana, where basically one excites the helium into a metastable state, which can then be optically pumped. And then through collisions, one winds up polarizing the ground state. And using this, you can get near unity polarization, I think around 70% in a time scale as short as on the order of 15 minutes. And so the cryostat, main cryostat design is as follows. We have this rotating gear here that's on a shaft that connects to a heated rotational stage. And then next to this rotating cylinder, we have three detectors. So each one of the detectors looking top down here is a quartz block that's coated with niobium and gold. We have the sample chamber here as a pancake shape to keep a lot of the material close as possible to the rotating cylinder. And then this is the rotating cylinder that spins around. So there are 11 segments in the cylinder to decouple the mechanical rotational frequency from the signal of interest. And the target nuclear Larmor precession frequency we're going for is between 50 and 100 hertz, with a density of about 10 to the 21 per cubic centimeter of helium-3. The sample volume is about a centimeter by a few millimeters by 150 microns, and the separation between these is on the order of 200 microns. And we use tungsten as the material here to get a high density. So with this system, then we project the following sensitivity. So depending on the T2, whether it's 1 second or up to 1,000 seconds, which is, I think, still perfectly reasonable for helium-3 systems, we can then carve out all the parameter space above this red band and now start to cut into the allowed range of the QCD axion. And in the future, if this experiment is successful, then we could think about scaling.
So the experiment is basically way too easy experiment, except that you are using Q.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with who's
way too neat.
Okay.
He did the first spin mass experiment using moving mass and detecting the...
Ah, okay, yeah. So I think the difference here is that we're using a resonant enhancement we're using the axion as the transverse field in NMR, essentially, to drive it. Yeah, and that Q factor gives you a big handle.
Yes.
Right? So then if this is successful, we can think about scaling up the system to a larger volume and then potentially ruling out all the parameter space above this projected reach line. And also a point of reference, the squid magnetometer sensitivity is somewhere down here. So we're not limited by the squid magnetometer. We're limited by the spin projection noise in the sample in these cases. OK, so I've got maybe 5 minutes left or yeah. So I just want to point out also the complementarity with neutron EDM experiments. So this upper end of the band here is set by the neutron EDM bound, so as they continue to improve, then this band will shrink. And if they do discover something, we can still make our measurement, of course, to measure the mass. And vice versa, if we discover something, we'll want them to make sure it's actually showing up in the neutron EDM so that we know we've seen the QCD axion as opposed to some other axion-like particle. So there's a nice connection here with the neutron EDM I just wanted to point out. Okay, so this is a highly non-trivial experiment, and there's a lot of systematic effects and noise sources that we're worried about. I'm not going to go over all of this, obviously, in the next 5 minutes, but I just want to give you the flavor of the kind of things we're worried about. Things like magnetic gradients, vibrations of the mass, external vibrations, the patch effect, flux noise in the squid loop, and trap flux noise in the shield, as well as magnetic noise from Johnson noise, the Barnett effect, which is basically the magnetization of our object upon its rotation, as well as magnetic impurities. And so experimentally now we're conducting a program where we're investigating and making strategies to deal with three of these things. So in particular, we're doing design and simulation work on reducing the magnetic gradients, and we're doing experimental testing on the vibration and also on our magnetic shielding. And so on the talk, Yang Ho will give a talk in a few days describing some of the work they're doing to characterize the shielding factor for the niobium that we're planning on using. Okay, so I think I'm going to skip over some of the details here on how we deal with magnetic gradients. We have strategies where we can use coils to control the magnetic gradient across the sample to keep a uniform field, to keep T2s on the order of hundreds of seconds to be feasible, and as well as strategies for tuning the background field. This sample is basically assembled in a quartz block that has the sphere spheroid containing the helium, as well as some coils to control the magnetic field. So we're in the process of testing this fabrication procedure. The source mass is tungsten. We have our first prototype that was just finished a few weeks ago. We've done some magnetic impurity testing in Indiana where the material looks pretty promising. We have impurities below the PPM level, which we think should be adequate for the sensitivity that we need. We're testing the vibration of this rotating structure and the spin speed. So we use fiber-coupled laser interferometers to measure the wobble of this thing as it's spinning in situ. So the interferometers have very good sensitivity of tens of picometers per hertz, which is more than enough that we need to characterize the wobble of that spinning object. And we also have precision stages that are capable of maintaining a constant rotation speed, where we've measured to better than part in 10,000 level at the frequencies that we need, which should allow us to keep the entire thing on resonance as it's spinning in the experiment. Okay, since I'm running short on time, I just want to conclude there. So we're doing experiments with optically levitated particles that are, we think, very promising for tests of gravity, possibly the Casimir force, which I didn't mention much about, and gravitational waves. And Ariadne is a new NMR-based method where we're trying to use it to close part of the gap here in the search for the QCD axion at the heavier end of its mass range, from hundreds of micro-EV to 10 milli-EV. That's really complementary to the other existing axion experiments. It has a number of advantages, for example, not needing to scan any frequencies to match the cosmic axion field. It's independent of cosmological assumptions because we're producing the axion in the lab, and we're undergoing tests at the moment for the shielding vibration in our helium-3 system. And with that, I just wanted to conclude and acknowledge our funding agencies and point out the people actually doing the work and thank everyone here for their attention.
So for the gravitational wave experiment, now people are going to huge test masses. Not only is resin mass so tight, but laser interferometers go to the next stage. They have to increase the mass.
Yes.
Hundreds of kilograms.
Yeah, that's right.
Now you have a nano sort of sphere.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Have you computed the thermal noise limit?
Yeah, so the limit that I'm showing for the gravitational wave is due to the thermal noise in the Brownian motion of the center mass of that object. Yep. And you're right that if we can get more mass, we have a better sensitivity. And so we have some ideas of how to improve the mass to make and also go to a little bit lower frequency in that same way. But we're not limited by, for example, the Brownian motion in the mirrors the way that the LIGO system, at least.
Less prone motion, which is great.
Right? Yeah.
It's a very nice talk there. Thanks. Two comments. One is that people always talk about the neutron EDM,
But in fact, the Mercury 199 experiment in Washington is a more sensitive measure of QCD, and more importantly, the slope at which that number is improving
is much faster. That's a fair comment. Yeah, I think actually the best limit on the neutronium is now from that.
It is.
Right. And I probably should maybe adjust if
no,
there was a...
The
I think it's...
There are a lot of uncertainties if you in the matrix element involved. If you want to translate to what the theta parameter is, then there are uncertainties in what the value, because what enters there for the value of the coupling is theta, in particular is the fundamental dipole moment of the up and down quarks. So it's a bit trickier to translate those bounds to what it is. But in principle, yes, if the bound improves, you push it down. So.
Well, no, but the paper quotes, bounds from respective clearness on theta QCD.
Yeah, I think those are slightly better than the neutron EDM. Yeah, that's right.
They are better.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's a very real thing is that the rate of progress is very much faster than it is for the neutron.
That's certainly true. Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's right. So that may actually start to affect our plot.
I think it's
plot. Yeah.
You either have to say, I know what's wrong with the theory that was used to get that.
Well, I'll leave that to...
By the way, it's only improved by factor of a few compared to what we have in that plot.
That's right.
I think it's like factor of three or something.
Factor of three is hard work.
Okay. No, I'm not saying that it's not hard work. I mean,
I'm saying that we should give credit to experimenters when they do something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It should be updated. I agree.
It is smaller, but there are bounds on the coupling to electrons.
Yes, I didn't talk about this, but that's absolutely right. Yeah.
And they're better than the existing experimental bounds on coupling to nucleons.
Yeah, that's right. So with the electrons,
it's
you also have some
and stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah, I didn't have time to mention that, but
that's
right. Yeah, so there's coupling to electrons versus nuclei, and there's a bunch of plots I could have.
ALPS is really talking about electrons, right?
ALPS is photons, right? So it's a Primakov effect. You have the axion to photon conversion back.
So this bound, what you see there from astrophysics is what the bound on the electron coupling of the QCD axion is not worse than what we showed there for the exclusion bounds. So that bound that comes from astrophysics on the axion to electron coupling is already included on this plot. The effect on the measurement of the EDM of the electron is much,
okay.
It's not constrained. The EDM of the electron does not constrain this theta parameter.
Right, I realize.
Yeah.
I'm just, what you're calling the astrophysical bound.
Yeah.
What that really is taking the cooling rate, stellar cooling rates, to find out something that couples to electrons, because the temperatures are not enough to produce nucleons, okay? The temperatures in the sun are KeV.
No, the astrophysical bound there takes into account the nucleon.
Yeah, there's a similar plot with the astrophysical bounds for the... Right.
We took our equivalence principle result to get the scalar coupling, and then you took the cooling rate from stars to get the pseudoscalar coupling, and he multiplied those two together.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So that's where that comes from. Okay.
So
that's where
didn't it?
No,
I see. But I thought it gets extrapolated for the neutron. There's a separate plot he has for the electron
versus
the.
Yes, he has for the neutrons too.
Yeah.
So he makes two separate.
So I think he.
So this
right.
is GP, the pseudoscalar coupling of the nucleon times the scalar coupling. And there's a separate plot that
GPE versus GPEG,
Yes,
right.
The separate plot that he has for the electron. So that does not. Yeah.
It's a separate plot with its own limits
right.
and on that other product
so
of the coupling, right?
So that would require using electron performs spins to detect the signal in this experiment.
Right, which this experiment is not designed to do. But yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but in principle, you can polarize the mass. If you were to, instead of unpolarized mass, if you were able to have spin polarized electron mass.
Yeah, then you could look for the dipole-dipole or whatever.
Yeah,
right? Yeah.
Looking for the electron coupling of the
atoms. Well, I'm saying we've done that one.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely right, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, when you were talking about the limits of being able to measure some glass bead moving around, or
yes.
I think when you were extrapolating this to gravitational waves, you were talking about the thermal occupation of the center of mass mode. I believe this is what your calculation was.
That's right.
When we think about our optical cavities and how well we can measure length, I mean, there is a fundamental or something like a center of mass mode, but that mode occupation, it's almost entirely irrelevant because we have thermo-optical or thermoelastic effects, right? The much higher order modes that, you know, have a much larger contribution. So where are the thermoelastic contributions?
Yeah, so because the particle is fairly rigid at its size, we mm-hmm. can basically disregard the breathing modes and the
right.
vibrational modes of the things that are not at center of mass. So the center of mass is very well decoupled
even
from those internal.
Even when you seal it up, you're saying. Increasing the size of this thing.
Oh well, I'm not sure. So we do those experiments with particles of one size, 300
sure.
nanometers, and for that size at least, mm-hmm. we can. I mean, I think if you, you know, there's a certain limit where you'd stop being able to do that. So for example, if you rather than using a sphere, used a disk, and you
sure.
made the disk very large, it would get very floppy, and then you'd no longer be able to neglect the mm-hmm. the.
But then 300 nanometers, I think those effects are.
That's
totally
right.
Relevant.
That's right, yeah.
And when you were mentioning gravitational wave detection with them,
right,
need to
yeah.
So
the idea here, right, would be, so you could either use a sphere or I suggested a disk. So in this case, for a disk of half a micron at 75 micron radius, you do start to, that's kind of the limit where you can still safely ignore those things, but if you make it any bigger, then you have to start worrying about that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
To say a few things about your magnetic gradient noise.
You mean in the Ariadne?
Yes.
Yeah. So I didn't have time to say much about it, but since you asked, So the idea we use the sample chamber has a spheroidal geometry, and we do that because the magnetic field inside a magnetized sphere is constant. If you deform the sphere into a spheroid. It's also a constant, as long as your magnetization is along one of the axes. But we need to have this superconducting shield right up against the object, right up against the sensor. And so we start off with this uniform magnetic field inside, which we want, but then we have this superconducting boundary, which is between the spinning mass and the device. And so what that causes is you can think about the effect of this, there's the Meissner effect, right, where the magnetic field cannot penetrate through the superconductor. And so you can analyze that mathematically as if you had an image spheroid across the boundary. And so then the magnetic field lines emanating from that image spheroid back on the original location of the spheroid are no longer constant. And so you wind up creating a magnetic gradient inside the spheroid just due to the Meissner effect, essentially, because you're forced to be up against that boundary. And what I didn't explain is that we have a method of canceling that out, essentially, by putting a set of coils. So if you have a coil on the axis here, you can take into account the field from the coil as well as its images and so forth. And you can take what started off as a fairly non-uniform field. This is in microtesla here, magnetic field, and flatten it out at the level about a part in 100 just by using that compensation coil.
How yeah. well are the nanospheres made in first
place? Yeah, so these are commercially bought, actually, and the companies are not particularly forthcoming with the exact details of how they make them.
This is not true to like such a thing. Thanks.
Yeah, so I think they're at a certain size, they're grown when they're really small, and eventually they're mechanically polished. If you get them in kind of microns, bigger than a few micron size, then they have some mechanical method. But I think the method that this company that I'm getting them from uses is called TIAS. It's some growth method. But again, they're not very specific about that.
How much do they vary in size and shape?
The size actually is, at least at the 300 nanometer size, the size is very uniform. So they spec the size at something like 5 to 10%. But in fact, if you put it in the SEM, they're more like 1%. But the density inside actually is not...
That's silica.
Silica, yeah. The density is not quite perfect. So we've actually done some testing where we do use a nano indenter to compress the material, and you can see that, in fact, you're not at full solid density based on the elastic properties. But we think it's about 2 rather than 2.2.
And is that factor constant?
That seems to be pretty uniform from piece to piece, yeah. So it's something to do with the growth method. So Giorgio also is doing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's set it.